Dozens of books have been written about the Iraq War, but so far, only one has been written by a high-ranking member of the Iraqi government. Make that former member. Ali Alawi resigned his post as finance minister in 2006 after getting too frustrated by the infighting in the transitional government. Steve Paulson talked with Alawi about his book, The Occupation of Iraq, Winning the War, Losing the Peace.
During Saddam Hussein's years in power, you were a prominent member of the opposition in exile, living for the most part in England. Back in 2002, did you support the American push to invade Iraq and overthrow Saddam?
Well, I mean, in 2002, it was becoming clear that the United States was practically on an irreversible course to invade. I must say, personally, I was skeptical because nobody really wants to see one's country invaded and occupied. It's not something that you would choose willingly, even if you're in mortal contest or combat with the regime in power. But my problem was that it was linked to what I thought were insufficient reasons to invade and occupy, namely the search for weapons of mass destruction and the war on terror. If it had a straight ethical content to it, in the sense that the United States finds it abhorrent or the international community finds it abhorrent that a state can commit such levels of repression against its own people and can cause such instability in the region, it had to be removed. That would have been, I think, a much better and more sound argument for invading a country, the ethical argument.
When did you realize that this war was not turning out the way the U.S. government had hoped for?
When I went back to Baghdad to join the government, I decided to keep a diary, really. And looking back at my diary entries, in October 2003, I made a personal jotting that this project is going to fail.
This was only half a year after U.S. forces went in. Already then, you realized this was a failure.
Yes. Well, this was half a year after the fall of the regime, but it was also only about 8 weeks after I became a minister that it became clear to me that the telltale signs of failure were there.
Why? What were the most obvious failures?
Well, the incoherence, the inappropriate administration, the mismanagement, the quality of people who were sent to administer a country about which very little was known in the United States, the tensions between the occupying administration and the Iraqi counterparts, both in the governing council and the cabinet, the low quality of people who were chosen to run the country, including, I might add, Iraqis. A lot of them were just incorrect. They were the wrong people in the wrong place. The whole thing just did not make sense to me.
Hmm. What's been the biggest surprise to you about what has happened since the coalition invasion in 2003? What did you simply not see coming?
What I underestimated, and I think many people underestimated, was the virulence and the violence used. I thought that after a few weeks, maybe months, of resistance on the part of the Sunni Arab community, they would somehow adjust to the changeover and accept a diminished status in the context of the formation of a non-sectarian state. But that didn't happen. Instead, we had a very, very violent response.
Why do you think that didn't happen?
I think because the invasion really upended centuries-old power relationships. What happened after the war was that the empowerment of the Shias was seen to be a complete disempowerment of the Sunnis.
Well, it certainly does raise the question of whether a non-sectarian form of government is possible in Iraq. I mean, whether you can have a ruling coalition made up of Kurds and Shia and Sunni. Is that possible? I mean, can people come together in good faith and together govern this country?
I think the problem in Iraq is really no longer between Arabs and Kurds, because there it's been, to a large extent, determined that the Kurds will take a very high degree of autonomy, maybe leading to some form of confederal arrangement. The problem in Iraq is within the Arab community, between the Shias and the Sunnis. I believe, yes, I believe if you have a very strong anti-discriminatory laws on sectarian basis and also on ethnic basis, so that sectarianism both in the public and the private sphere becomes punishable, I think you can create over time a kind of new Iraqi consciousness. But whether you can do that in the present context is very difficult.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because a lot of people say that Iraq simply wasn't ready for democracy. I mean, this is a country that, for whatever cultural and political and historical reasons, just was not ripe for that form of government. It sounds like you wouldn't necessarily say that.
No, I wouldn't say that because, okay, what's the alternative? Is that we continue with dictatorship? I think in spite of all the flaws of democracy and the problems of having democracy without Democrats, as it were, it still is better than an authoritarian system that may give you stability, but can be prone to moving into extremes of violence and repression, which is what happened in Iraq.
Yeah. Now, you have had very much an insider's perspective on Iraq over the last few years. You've been part of the post-war governing coalition, first as Minister of Defense between 2003 and 2004, then Minister of Finance between 2005 and 2006. And along the way, you have made some interesting personal choices, such as choosing to live outside the Green Zone in Baghdad. Why did you do that?
For the most prosaic reasons, because my house is there. My family house is outside of the Green Zone. So I prefer to live in my own house. But with that said, I really wanted to also make a point. I mean, I didn't want to live in a cocoon, a fortress-like cocoon, where you have all the, you know, creature comforts and power is uninterrupted and relatively safe and all of that. But you're completely disconnected with the rest of the country. But there were negative consequences of that. One of them is that wherever I had to travel from, let's say, my home to the ministry, you had to be very carefully on guard against ambushes and assassins and so on. And
well, wasn't your convoy ambushed twice?
My convoy was ambushed twice. Once it was really a very serious affair. We were attacked in a square by shooters who were around buildings around it, something the equivalent of sort of Times Square in New York, the Baghdad version of it. Another time I had stopped my convoy for lunch and some of my guards went out to provide lunch for the security detail. There's about 60 of them.
60 people in your security detail?
Yes.
Wow.
They were attacked by a suicide bomber. So I lost 3 of my guards killed to a suicide bomber and 6 very badly wounded. That obviously shook us up considerably. It's a frightening, well, terrifying experience.
Yeah.
To just watch it. So it became increasingly unsafe. So this symbolic gesture also had its costs.
Just so I understand this, you're saying that every time you went from your home into the government offices, you were accompanied by 60 security guards?
Yes, I mean, I was traveling in a convoy of between 12 to 15 cars. Well, not cars, they're armored SUVs, most of them. Because the ministry, especially in the last years, the Ministry of Finance was about several miles away from my house. We had to leave at the crack of dawn, really just to avoid traffic jams and to avoid ambushes. The routine was really that. You get up in the morning at around dawn, I mean 5 o'clock, 4:30. You zoom off to the ministry. I spent the entire day there and then zoomed from the ministry to the Green Zone, which was about 3 miles away, to attend various government functions. And then around 7 o'clock in the evening, zoom from the Green Zone to my house, which is about 3 miles away, and have, you know, some light dinner or something, and by 9:30, 9 o'clock, I was in bed. It's a very circumscribed life.
This sounds kind of like an unreal existence, frankly. I mean, what does it feel like to live that kind of life?
Terrible. It's very, you know, solitary also, because you can't go out. My family was still in London when I was living there. And you end up in a sort of in an intense relationship with one or two people whom you see on a daily basis, practically. You have, obviously, a kind of intense relationship with your bodyguards. And since I avoided extensive, you know, politicking and so on, I didn't really have much of a social life in the end.
What's your best educated guess as to what Iraq will look like 10 years from now?
Unless there is a really concerted effort to convene some kind of international congress on the effects of the Iraq war and to limit it and to define it, I think Iraq would be not too different from what we see today. I think Kurdistan will become far more established as a peace and security zone. I think the central government will be definitely under the control of large Shia Islamist parties. And there will be a degree of violence and disturbance and insecurity in the other areas, probably less than what we have today, but it will be an unstable equilibrium.
Basically, you're saying that without extraordinary measures, there will be simmering civil war for years and years.
Yes, but, you know, everything ends, even civil wars end. But civil wars usually end, according to the academics, by one party vanquishing the other. I don't think this will happen in Iraq, because even though the Sunni Arabs are in a demographic minority, they are connected to a much broader world from which they draw their strength. And therefore, they are in a rough balance inside Iraq. And it is very difficult then to have one side vanquish the other, as sort of what happened in the American Civil War or the Spanish Civil War. So I think you will get state control, and it would be enough for probably 70% of the population, but the rest would be in a state of either antipathy to the order, or they would be in a state of violent resistance to it.
Ali Alawi speaking with Steve Paulson. Alawi's book is called The Occupation of Iraq, Winning the War, Losing the Peace.